G'day, folks, and welcome. I'm Chris Faber.
And I'm TJ Steadman.
And you're listening to the Answers to Giant Questions podcast, coming to you from sunny Western Australia.
G'day, folks, and welcome back to the Answers to Giant Questions podcast, the show that tackles your questions about the biblical giants. Last week, we were looking at the Exodus, and we noticed a lot of things that came up in the flood story.
That's right, Chris. We sure did. So one of the things we've been talking about on the podcast, and I also go into some detail on this in my book, is the idea that Israelite history is seen through the interpretive lens of the Exodus and other formative events in their past to help them make sense of other narratives, in particular, the flood story, as we're finding out.
Yeah, but what do you mean by other formative events, Tim? Are you saying that there are other stories in the Bible that we need to know about in order to understand the flood story properly?
Yeah, that's right, mate. And we're going to focus on one of those in particular today. But before I introduce that story, what I really want to do is sort of reverse engineer this whole thing and explain why we're doing that. I want to talk about why we would want to understand certain other things in Israel's history and in their worldview before we get into some of the inspiration for that. I've been talking through this whole season about Jewish eschatology, or their understanding of things of the future from their perspective, and how the flood story forms an essential part of that framework. And we're going to see part of that today as we talk about the hope of the resurrection.
So I take it that we're not basing this on the text in Genesis then?
Well, we're going to have to do a lot of homework before we can approach the text and hear what a Jewish listener would have heard in it. So it's going to tie back into our text. But if that's where we start, we won't necessarily see what's going on. We've got some catching up to do. Now, we talked last week about the language of opening and closing that's found in the flood story here in chapter 7 and the beginning of chapter 8. And we were able to see how that relates to things that were happening on a cosmic level in both the seen and unseen world around us. We had that stuff in the Song of Moses in Exodus 15 about the earth swallowing up Pharaoh and the Egyptians. And we saw in that a parallel to the fate of the Nephilim and the fallen sons of God in the flood. We previously talked about the three-tiered cosmology of the ancient world, where you had the heavens above, which represented the origin of all good things and life-giving spiritual powers. Then you have the earth itself, where humans live and conduct their business. And then you have the underworld, which is the domain of the dead and of the powers of death. And we're told that the fate of all humans was this miserable existence in the underworld, which was merely a shadow of the former earthly life. Moses implies that the pursuing Egyptians certainly wound up in the underworld, more commonly known as Sheol elsewhere, or the pit, or Abaddon. In that text, we just saw the word usually translated as earth, which is Eretz. However, ancient Israelite and Jewish belief differed from that of the ancient Near East in general by virtue of their hope for not only a renewed life after death, but a full cosmic renewal for the righteous, in which renewed bodily existence could be enjoyed, and which was centered around the creative work of God and true worship of and fellowship with him. So at this point, I want to bring out an excellent point made in a journal article I found online about this. The paper is called Not Abandoned to Sheol, The Psalms and Hope for the Righteous After Death. And it's written by Kyle Dunham. It was published in 2021 in the journal Bibliotheca Sacra. I'm just summarizing here, but what Dunham says is basically this. Evidence of this distinction is found in that there is no faithful Israelite in the entire Hebrew Bible who's actually said to go to Sheol. And I would add here, say for Jonah, who's acting unfaithfully at the time but gets brought back from there by God to finish his prophetic ministry. Dunham says that others in Scripture talk about Sheol as the fate of the unrighteous or as something that they fear but don't actually experience. When the good guys die, we see expressions like, he slept with his fathers, or he was gathered to his ancestors. At no point is a faithful Israelite said to pass away with a descent into Sheol featured in the narrative. So they're not afraid of dying, but they certainly don't want to go to Sheol because that's where the bad guys go.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that before, but he makes a good point.
Yeah, although it's commonly thought this belief system developed late in Israelite history, I think, and Dunham's on the same page here, that it would be more accurate to suggest that biblical stories show the movement of God's people into this belief system rather than their invention of it. We generally call that progressive revelation. We're getting taken through this from the beginning. So we begin with the Amorite pagan Abraham, who doesn't know any of this, and end with the fledgling Christian church, all the while maintaining this consistent eschatology that they're still figuring out. And Noah is representative of those early beginnings and the first steps towards God since the fall of man. So ultimately, we're coming back to the flood today, but what I want to show is why that's important for Jewish eschatology, or the study of the last things, which isn't necessarily about the end of time, but certainly what happens after we die. And of course, you can't talk about eschatology for both Jews and Christians without at least taking into consideration the revelation of Jesus Christ as recorded by the Apostle John.
You get the feeling we're in for a wild ride. Last time we talked about Revelation, it certainly, you know, generated some interesting discussion online, and that's a good thing, I think, because it shows that people are engaging with the content and actually thinking about these ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. We're coming back again to Revelation 12, which we've addressed in some limited detail in previous episodes. Again, this isn't going to be a deep dive here, but I just want to draw your attention to some of the language. So Revelation 12, verses 13 to 17. And when the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. But the woman was given the two wings of the great eagle, so that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness to the place where she is to be nourished for a time and times and half a time. The serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman to sweep her away with a flood. But the earth came to the help of the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from his mouth. Then the dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. And he stood on the sand of the sea. Now, I know this has been mentioned before, but once again, I just want to draw your attention to this particular language here of flood, which we concluded previously was a reference to some hostile action taking place on the earth in real time around the advent of Christ. And that is followed up with the idea of the earth opening up its mouth and swallowing this flood. And in a recent episode of the podcast, we saw that same language of the idea that some kind of mouth in the earth could open up and swallow the enemies of God. That was most explicit in the book of Jubilees, which is, once again, going to have some impact for the Apostle John later on when he talks about the millennium, but that'll be a discussion for another time. The point for our purposes being that since John was clearly familiar with the Enochian corpus, we shouldn't be surprised to find language and themes deriving from that material. So that in itself is going to help us understand the direction from which we need to be approaching Jewish eschatology, at least as it appears in the Christian New Testament. And while that's not an argument for canonicity of the pseudepigrapha, it is why we've been taking this approach to the flood story, because it's interpreted through that same apocalyptic lens.
Okay, that makes sense.
Looking at the text we just read in Revelation, it's understandable that so many have been confused by this particular little pericope within John's apocalyptic vision. What does it mean to suggest that the earth helped the woman by opening its mouth to swallow up the flood? And why was the dragon so furious about it? I'm going to suggest that this little passage has a lot to do with the preservation of the righteous, keeping them out of Sheol, and the destruction of the wicked who end up in there. And that's what made the Lord of the Dead so mad.
That's a hot take for sure. I've never heard anything like that before.
Yeah, don't worry. I'll have this all explained and making sense in no time at all.
Sure. If there's one thing I know about you, Tim, it's that you get to the point really fast.
Yeah, you won't be thinking that by the end of this episode.
Probably.
Now, the problem with a topic like the resurrection is that you've got a lot of people claiming that ancient Israelites never believed in the resurrection and that they didn't have any hope of some glorious afterlife. You've got to wonder if they've been reading the same Bible that we have. Case in point is Psalm 16. And I'll just read you verses 8 to 11 from Psalm 16. I have set the Lord always before me, because he is at my right hand, I shall not be shaken. Therefore my heart is glad and my whole being rejoices. My flesh also dwells secure. For you will not abandon my soul to Sheol, or let your Holy One see corruption. You make known to me the path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. Now, Dunham's argument is that the line, for you will not abandon my soul to Sheol, is intended to be understood not as, I'm in Sheol, but I trust you to get me out. But instead, I trust that you won't allow me to experience Sheol when I die. And there's some complex grammar behind that argument. You can read his paper if you want the nuts and bolts. Now, it should be obvious to anyone who's familiar with this psalm that it gets quoted in the New Testament with reference to Jesus himself. And that's important, because it means this passage forms a legitimate part of the discussion about the afterlife here, and not only preservation from some present danger. This is from the Apostle Peter's speech in Acts chapter 2, and read from verse 22. Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know. This Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. God raised him up, loosing the pangs of death, because it was not possible for him to be held by it. For David says concerning him, I saw the Lord always before me, for he is at my right hand, that I may not be shaken. Therefore my heart was glad and my tongue rejoiced. My flesh also will dwell in hope. For you will not abandon my soul to Hades, or let your Holy One see corruption. You have made known to me the paths of life. You will make me full of gladness with your presence. Brothers, I may say to you with confidence about the patriarch David, that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. Being therefore a prophet, and knowing that God had sworn with an oath to him that he would set one of his descendants on his throne, he foresaw and spoke about the resurrection of the Christ, that he was not abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. This Jesus God raised up, and of that we all are witnesses. Being therefore exalted at the right hand of God, and having received from the Father the promise of the Holy Spirit, he has poured out this that you yourselves are seeing and hearing. For David did not ascend into the heavens, but he himself says, The Lord said to my Lord, Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. Let all the house of Israel therefore know for certain that God has made him, both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified.
And this comes up again later in the book of Acts, chapter 13, right?
Yeah, this is Paul this time speaking about Jesus. Chapter 13, verse 28. And though they found in him no guilt worthy of death, they asked Pilate to have him executed. And when they had carried out all that was written of him, they took him down from the tree and laid him in a tomb. But God raised him from the dead, and for many days he appeared to those who had come up with him from Galilee to Jerusalem, who are now his witnesses to the people. And we bring you the good news that what God promised to the fathers, this he has fulfilled to us their children, by raising Jesus. As also it is written in the second Psalm, You are my son, today I have begotten you. And as for the fact that he raised him from the dead, no more to return to corruption, he has spoken in this way, I will give you the holy and sure blessings of David. Therefore he says also in another Psalm, You will not let your Holy One see corruption. For David, after he had served the purpose of God in his own generation, fell asleep and was laid with his fathers and saw corruption. But he whom God raised up did not see corruption. Let it be known to you, therefore, brothers, that through this man forgiveness of sins is proclaimed to you, and by him everyone who believes is freed from everything from which you could not be freed by the law of Moses. That's the end of the quote. So the question now becomes, how is it that a fisherman and a Pharisee are both able to arrive at the conclusion that life after death and the resurrection of the dead is what David was referring to in Psalm 16, and why use that text to support the idea in the New Testament, if that totally wasn't a thing?
Good point, and should be obvious enough, I guess. Paul actually said in verse 32, and we bring you the good news that what God promised to the fathers, this he has fulfilled to us, their children, by raising Jesus.
Exactly. Now, it's quite obvious that there are messianic connections between David and Christ, which I'm sure for most Christians you should already be aware of. So I'm not really looking at that here. The primary issue is in reading this as a reference to bodily resurrection and a positive view of the afterlife for the faithful. If the idea of the resurrection of the righteous really is just a first century invention of Christians, then there must be some more to it than simply taking one of David's psalms, apparently, out of context. We're looking for something from the Old Testament more broadly that will substantiate the worldview presented by the apostles in support of the resurrection. Now, I mentioned both the opening of the earth and the resurrection of the dead, and those ideas go in tandem in a number of places. We're actually going to see it again at the crucifixion. So this is Matthew 27 from verses 45 to 54. Now from the sixth hour there was darkness over all the land until the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani, that is, my God, why have you forsaken me? And some of the bystanders, hearing it, said, This man is calling Elijah. And one of them at once ran and took a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a reed, and gave it to him to drink. But the other said, Wait, let's see whether Elijah will come to save him. And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And the earth shook, and the rocks were split. The tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. When the centurion and those who were with him, keeping watch over Jesus, saw the earthquake and what took place, they were filled with awe and said, "Truly this was the Son of God." All right, so that's the end of the reading. Of course, there is a reason why I chose this particular passage, and it isn't only the earthquake and the bodily resurrection from the dead. Because I took you back a little earlier for a bit more context, and we read the words of Jesus from the cross and the way that Matthew records people talking about Elijah the prophet. You know, one of the things that Elijah was most famous for was raising someone from the dead. So I guess why they were speculating about that at the scene of the crucifixion. So that should get us thinking more about this idea of hope for the afterlife, because if you know your Old Testament at all, you know that there are not just one or two instances where people are in fact raised from the dead. I think we can safely dispense with the idea that this was a first century Christian invention, despite the repeated insistence of critical scholars. But we still have questions here.
Yeah, I have a question. What's going on in the Old Testament where people get raised from the dead, huh?
All right, let's have a look at that. We'll start with Samuel, son of Hannah. First, the bit where he dies, and then we'll read about when he comes back. This is 1 Samuel 25, verse 1. "Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him in his house at Ramah." All right, so he's definitely dead and buried. Now we'll move a little further forward in the story and read about his reappearance. This is 1 Samuel 28 from verse 13. "The king," that is Saul, "said to her," the necromancer, "do not be afraid. What do you see?" And the woman said to Saul, "I see an Elohim coming up out of the earth." He said to her, "What is his appearance?" And she said, "An old man is coming up, and he is wrapped in a robe." And Saul knew that it was Samuel, and he bowed with his face to the ground and paid homage. Then Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" Saul answered, "I am in great distress, for the Philistines are warring against me, and God has turned away from me and answers me no more, either by prophets or by dreams. Therefore I have summoned you to tell me what I shall do." And Samuel said, "Why then do you ask me, since the Lord has turned from you and become your enemy? The Lord has done to you as he spoke by me, for the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor David. Because you did not obey the voice of the Lord and did not carry out his fierce wrath against Amalek, therefore the Lord has done this thing to you this day. Moreover, the Lord will give Israel also with you into the hand of the Philistines, and tomorrow you and your sons shall be with me."
I'd like to say that's the first time I've heard that evil laugh, but it's not. So how do we know that was really Samuel back from the dead?
Well, the biblical author certainly believes it was him because he tells us who it was. He names the guy as Samuel, and he doesn't say it's a ghost that looks like Samuel, the witch pretends to see Samuel, or it's a demon impersonating Samuel, or anything like that. And although the witch says she sees him coming up from the earth, we don't have evidence that she was referring to Sheol proper, or even that she understood what was going on at all. So even if we say that God's faithful don't actually go to Sheol, as Dunham argues, the witch may not have a frame of reference to make that distinction. After all, her work would be centered around dealings with the unrighteous dead most of the time, I'd imagine.
Fair enough.
So that was the first case in the scripture of a person being raised from the dead, albeit temporarily. But then we've got some more we can look at, which a bit more clearly pictures of bodily resurrection. Let's look at Elijah and the widow's son. This is 1 Kings 17 from verse 17. "After this, the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, became ill, and his illness was so severe that there was no breath left in him. And she said to Elijah, 'What have you against me, O man of God? You have come to me to bring my sin to remembrance and to cause the death of my son.' And he said to her, 'Give me your son.' And he took him from her arms and carried him up into the upper chamber where he lodged, and laid him on his own bed. And he cried to the Lord, 'O Lord my God, have you brought calamity even upon the widow with whom I sojourn by killing her son?' Then he stretched himself upon the child three times and cried to the Lord, 'O Lord my God, let this child's life come into him again.' And the Lord listened to the voice of Elijah, and the life of the child came into him again, and he revived. And Elijah took the child and brought him down from the upper chamber into the house and delivered him to his mother. And Elijah said, "See, your son lives." Now, that was a story about Elijah the prophet. And as you know, his prophetic mantle, so to speak, was passed on to his disciple Elisha when Elijah was taken up into heaven.
Yeah, that's the bit with the whirlwind and the chariots of fire.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, actually. It's going to be important later on. And Elisha goes on to do even greater things, including the resurrection of the son of another widow. Let's have a look at that story. This is 2 Kings chapter 4. I'm just going to read a little bit here from verse 32 to 35. When Elisha came into the house, he saw the child lying dead on his bed. So he went in and shut the door behind the two of them and prayed to the Lord. Then he went up and lay on the child, putting his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on his eyes, and his hands on his hands. And as he stretched himself upon him, the flesh of the child became warm. Then he got up again and walked once back and forth in the house and went up and stretched himself upon him. The child sneezed 7 times and the child opened his eyes. All right, so that's that one. And the hits keep coming with Elisha. Elijah raises one dead guy, but Elisha does two. He doesn't even have to be alive himself to do it. This is crazy. This is the story of the dead man in Elisha's grave. 2 Kings 13, verse 21. And as a man was being buried, behold, a marauding band was seen, and the man was thrown into the grave of Elisha. And as soon as the man touched the bones of Elisha, he revived and stood on his feet. So they've got the body of Elisha in an open grave next to this other one where some other guy's about to be buried. And when they spot these hostile invaders approaching from a foreign land, the guys who are burying him freak out and they just chuck the body on top of the body of Elisha and get out of there. But as soon as that dead man's body touches the bones of Elisha, he comes back to life. And the tradition of the church is that since Elisha is at that time already experiencing the resurrection in some way, although not fully with a complete bodily resurrection, the life that he has and the glory that he has in that state were able to impart life to the body of the dead man who was thrown into his grave. So the idea is that this resurrection wouldn't be possible if it were not for the inherent life that Elisha himself still possessed, even though his body lay dead in that grave.
That's pretty awesome, I gotta say. Okay, so we had a few stories there about people coming back from the dead, but what I'd really like to see is some kind of common thread that ties them all together so we can understand what's going on.
All right, so to do that, I'm going to be reading some quotes from a paper by David Mitchell. He's a biblical scholar and musicologist, as well as a published author. He wrote in the Journal for the Study of the Old Testament, volume 30, number 3. This was 2006. And the paper is called God Will Redeem My Soul from Sheol, The Psalms of the Sons of Korah. And Mitchell's going to begin with a little piece here about Hannah, who was the mother of Samuel. Remember, we were talking about Samuel before, and I made a point of mentioning Hannah. Mitchell says this: Hannah was a Korahite, perhaps by birth, certainly by marriage to the Korahite Elkanah. Most of all, she is a Korahite in spirit. In the prayer recording her first spoken words, she becomes the first person in the Bible to utter the name Yahweh Tsevaot, that is, Lord of Hosts. That's 1 Samuel 1, verse 11. Like her Korahite forebears, she speaks of redemption from Sheol. The Lord kills and makes live. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. 1 Samuel 2, verse 6. Indeed, her words were fulfilled in her son, who was the first certified dead person in the Bible to come up, albeit temporarily, from Sheol. That's the end of the quote. So Mitchell's given us a clue here as to how Samuel fits into this puzzle about the resurrection, even if he doesn't necessarily recognize any distinction between who Hannah says that Yahweh brings down to Sheol and raises up. Now he's going to talk about resurrection from the point of view of the ancient Canaanites, and that's going to give us a link to the prophet Elijah, who we were talking about earlier. So Mitchell says this: resurrection was familiar among the Canaanites in the second millennium BC. At the Ugaritic New Year festival, Baal and his retinue of Rapa'um, we know them in the Hebrew Bible as the Rephaim, deified royal ancestors, appeared from the underworld on chariots as the stars of heaven and the warriors of Baal and Anat. They were known also as the cohorts of Reshef of the Host, or Reshef Sebai, since Reshef, the god of plague, war, and fire, was associated with their revivification. Try saying that 5 times fast. Revivification. So Mitchell's given us some thoughts that introduce the idea of the Hebrew God assuming the title Lord of Hosts, and we're going to see that title used several times as we go through these various passages of Scripture today. And he's connected the fiery chariots of the Rephaim with the ascension of Elijah. In that, he's showing that the authors of the Hebrew Bible are subverting Canaanite mythology about their gods and their hope of an afterlife. We should take note that in Canaanite culture, this resurrection was available only to the elite of society, not the common man. Now, he's going to show us how Elijah and Elisha, the prophets of Yahweh, connect with the descendants of Korah, just like the prophet Samuel. So Mitchell says this, "Indeed, one might think that Elijah and Elisha look rather like Korahites themselves, with their Yahweh of hosts and raising of the dead, but both are tantalizingly scant of genealogy. Elijah we know only as a Tishbite from Tishbe," that's 1 Kings 17 verse 1, "though rabbinic tradition speaks of his priestly descent. Elisha is only Ben Shaphat, son of a landowner from Abel Meholah," that's 1 Kings 19, 16. "Is the trail cold? Perhaps not. We turn to the story of the small boys of Bethel who jeered Elisha," that's 2 Kings 2, verse 23 and 24. "It's a strange tale. One always feels like one is missing the point. Is it only to tell us that Elisha had a bald patch, or is it to show, as some say, that Israel's prophets were tonsured?" That means, you know, to have the top of their head shaven. "But that idea is uncorroborated elsewhere and seems hardly relevant here. Perhaps something has been overlooked." It's the end of his quote. So here's that story about Elisha and the bears from 2 Kings 2, 23 to 24. It says this, "From there, Elisha went up to Bethel. As he was walking up the path, some small boys came out of the city and jeered at him, chanting, 'Go up, Baldy, go up, Baldy.' He turned around, looked at them, and cursed them in the name of the Lord. Then two female bears came out of the woods and mauled 42 of the children."
Yeah, weird story. But as a fellow Baldy, I always wondered what we're supposed to make of that.
So Mitchell then goes on to explain that the small boy's taunt of bald head in Hebrew is Keriah, nearly identical to Korah. Mitchell says this, "Korah basically means bald. Derisory puns on names are as old as the confusion of tongues, and one would imagine that Keriah would have been an obvious and familiar insult for Korahites, popular with urchins." So let's imagine for a moment that Elisha was a Korahite, and known as such by reputation or appearance. He comes to Bethel, the metropolis of Jeroboam's bull cult, that's Amos 7:13. As an orthodox prophet of Yahweh, he would have been a rare bird there, an immediate figure of fun to the spawn of the city. So they begin their catcalls. "Go up," as in to worship at our shrine. "Keriah." It must have been a great joke, even better if Elisha had a receding hairline, like shouting "Bald One" after a bald man called Baldwin, but with an added frisson of religious and tribal derision. Therefore, if Keriah was a jibe against Korahite Elisha, everything clicks into place. The elusive point of the story appears. It is another showdown between the prophets of Yahweh and idolatrous Israel. Elisha's harsh reaction is explained, for they were not laughing at his shiny pate, but at the second commandment and his tribal loyalty to it. The hypothesis is confirmed by there being 42 boys mauled by the bears. For in the Psalms, at least, 42 is the Korahite number. The first Korah Psalm is Psalm 42, introducing the first Korah group and the Eloistic Psalter. And then 42 Psalms later, Psalm 84 introduces the second Korah group and the second Yahweh collection. There even appears to have been a Hebrew tradition associating this very passage with the Korah Psalms. So it rather looks like the writer of 2 Kings 2, 23 to 24, is telling us in his cryptic way that the innominate Ben Shaphat is a Korahite incognito.
That makes sense. Hey, Tim, you know, I was just thinking, what is so special about these Korahites and what do they have to do with the resurrection from the dead?
Now, you might be thinking, what's so special about these Korahites? And what do they have to do with the resurrection from the dead? I bet you're thinking that. Here's another quote from Mitchell. "Korah ben Izhar ben Kohath was a prominent Levite and a cousin of Moses. Their fathers, Izhar and Amram, were brothers. Eminent among the people and wealthy, He resented Moses giving the headship of the Kohathite clan to a lesser relative, Elizaphan. That's Numbers 3, verse 30. So he led a rebellion against Moses and Aaron together with some Reubenites, Dathan, Abiram, and On, and 250 Levites. I'll break in here and we'll just read the story for ourselves rather than the summary. So this is the story of the rebellion of Korah from Numbers chapter 16. Start at verse 1. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, son of Kohath, son of Levi, and Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took men, and they rose up before Moses with a number of the people of Israel, 250 chiefs of the congregation chosen from the assembly, well-known men. They assembled themselves together against Moses and against Aaron, and said to them, "You have gone too far. For all in the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" When Moses heard it, he fell on his face. And he said to Korah and all his company, "In the morning the Lord will show who is his and who is holy, and will bring him near to him. The one whom he chooses, he will bring near to him." And the story goes on to give a bit of detail about how this confrontation is going to go down between them.
Yeah, this bit kind of reminds me of the classic, you know, trapdoor gag in the cartoons where the unsuspecting victim is being encouraged to position himself over the trapdoor, you know. "Could you stand a little to the left? A bit more, bit more. That's it."
But I didn't say you will.
Eee.
All right, we'll pick it up again in verse 25. Then Moses rose and went to Dathan and Abiram, and the elders of Israel followed him. And he spoke to the congregation, saying, "Depart, please, from the tents of these wicked men, and touch nothing of theirs, lest you be swept away with all their sins." So they got away from the dwelling of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the door of their tents together with their wives, their sons, and their little ones. You might notice that detail is absent concerning Korah. And Moses said, "Hereby you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works, and that it has not been of my own accord. If these men die, as all men die, or if they are visited by the fate of all mankind, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord creates something new, and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that belongs to them, and they go down alive into Sheol, then you shall know that these men have despised the Lord." And as soon as he had finished speaking all these words, the ground under them split apart, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their households and all the people who belonged to Korah and all their goods. So they and all that belonged to them went down alive into Sheol, and the earth closed over them, and they perished, that's the Hebrew abad, from the midst of the assembly. And all Israel who were around them fled at their cry, for they said, "Lest the earth swallow us up." And fire came out from the Lord and consumed the 250 men offering the incense. All right, so we'll leave the reading there and go back to Mitchell's paper. Mitchell says this: "The tale continues in Numbers 26, where more details emerge. First, unlike the children of Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Korah did not die." That's Numbers 26, verse 11. Apparently, unlike the Reubenite boys in Numbers 16:27, they did not stand by their father at the showdown. Second, we read in Numbers 26:10 that they became a sign. Whether this refers only to the 250 devoured by fire, or to all the cast of the rebellion, including the sons of Korah, is not clear. But the phrase is significant. The Korah event is a sign, pointing presumably to things to come. That's the end of the quote.
All right, folks. Well, it looks like this episode is going to be longer than anticipated.
Are you insinuating that I might be taking too long to get to the point?
So we go to take a break here, and when we return next week, we'll bring you the conclusion to this episode.
We'll also have the Q&A, where we talk about the significance of the age at which Jesus began his ministry.
Yeah, it's going to be a good one. Don't miss it. We'll catch you next time on the Answers to Giant Questions podcast.
It's time to wrap up today's episode, but if you want more, don't forget to get yourself a copy of Answers to Giant Questions. We're asking readers to please leave a review of the book on Amazon or Goodreads to help it become more visible in search results. Even if you just give it stars, that'll help, but a full review is certainly really appreciated. Please also leave a review of this podcast wherever you found us so that new listeners can find us here on the show. This podcast comes out every week, but you want to make sure you never miss an episode, so if you haven't already subscribed, do that now. and you'll get notified when each new episode drops. We'll catch you next time on the Answers to Giant Questions podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Answers to Giant Questions podcast, a production of the Raven Creek Social Club. If you like what you heard today, please take a moment to rate or review the show. Music supplied under copyright by Grave Forsaken, graveforsaken.com. You can get the book Answers to Giant Questions by TJ Stedman on Amazon in paperback and Kindle format. Check out the other podcasts at ravencreeksc.com and go to giantanswers.com for more answers to giant questions. Read the blog and catch us on the socials. Don't forget to subscribe and tell your friends about the show. Send us your giant questions and stay tuned to this podcast to get answers. We'll see you next time. Until then, stay safe and God bless.
So yeah, big one. And it was tough, man. I had to put in a lot of research into this.
Yeah,
I spent longer than I normally would and did a lot more reading than I normally do. And I do revise my work and my opinions and my thoughts on things.
Oh, wow. Okay.
More than I normally do.
Yeah. Gosh. Okay.
I really don't like to waffle on, you know. I try to be as brief and succinct and concise as I possibly can at all times where possible. I mean, some people really can talk too much, and I don't think I'm one of those because I know when to keep my mouth shut. People tell me all the time that I hardly talk at all. If somebody tells me that it's time to shut up, that's fine. I can shut up. I know when to shut up. I'm not one to keep on talking after I've been told to shut up. You know, some people can just go on and on and on, but not me. I'm not one of those. I'm quiet as a mouse, silent like a fox. I'm about as quiet as a snowflake falling on a feather pillow, a dandelion seed drifting on a gentle spring breeze, a newt farting in a vacuum.